NPR station.
Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm filling in today for Rob Lori. He'll be back in this time slot on Monday. Today, we're going to revisit an important environmental story in Florida, which in the last few months has spread even further into parts of the Caribbean. We'll get an update about a devastating coral disease known as stony coral tissue loss disease. Our guest is a scientist in St. Petersburg, and we'll also look at more at bills that are moving through the Florida legislature this week. We'll also take your calls. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And I want to thank you for listening to 88.5 WMNF.org. First up in the show, we're going to listen to some comments that were left by listeners about yesterday's show. Our guest yesterday was Susan Smith, the former president of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida. Here are what two listeners had to say.
Sean, this is Kara. I just caught the tail end of your show. I just wanted to comment on how I feel it's really ridiculous that the popular narrative around what democracy, how we can exercise democracy is, because the conversation is always going back to voting and electing people. There was a caller commenting in on citizens' amendments. And the answer was that those are impossible, basically, because they're $15 million. So I just wanted to call in to point out that that's not how we practice democracy. It goes kind of unchecked in the popular conversation. Bringing amendments to the people costing $15 million as just one example, and then funneling the conversation and that whatever $15 million funding back into the elections industry is not democracy. And I think that's a topic we could be talking about a lot more. But thanks for your show and thanks for the time. All right, bye.
St. Pete, I was just listening to the show today, and I wanted to make a comment on arming teachers. I mean, insanity. This is beyond the pale of evil that you would want to put more guns in the public schools. And we keep debating this issue over and over and over. And we're losing. More guns are getting on the streets of America. Now, people should realize the history of the state of Florida, since I've been here in the last 30 years, but even in the history of the state of Florida, if you wanted to go back to 1861, today we are ruled by great, great, great grandchildren of the Confederacy. On both sides of the fence, Democrats and Republicans, and we know if you go back to 1861, the Democratic Party ran the Confederacy. The Democratic Party was the small government party, don't tax the rich, the antebellum South, slavery, slave labor, and the list goes on. The radical Republicans of Lincoln's party, which were the heart and soul of Lincoln's party, were the progressive socialists, were the ones that pushed for civil rights and the abolishing of slavery, and the list goes on. Most Trumpsters and neocons today do not realize this. And I cannot emphasize this enough. The country is still ruled by Reaganism, no matter who is in the White House. And if you look at the last three administrations, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. Barack Obama did what he could, and I salute him, for the expansion of Medicaid, which brings me to the state of Florida, that there's almost 1 million people, at least that we know of, that do not have health care because Rick Scott rejected the federal money that was there. And this is all through the Confederate South, let alone the red states in the United States of America that rejected this money. The legislation that is passed in the state of Florida is anti-labor, anti-union, anti-women, anti-seniors, and the list goes on.
Well, those were two listeners commenting about our show yesterday, and it's on our website, WMNF.org/news. If you'd like to listen to it later on in the broadcast, they'll give out the number for you to call to leave a voicemail about today's show. You can always listen to previous shows and comment on the stories on our website. You can join us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at WMNF News. Well, I just want to remind you that this is Radioactivity on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. And we'd like your participation today. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by a scientist scientists in St. Petersburg to talk about what one of my previous guests called the most extensive coral disease outbreaks ever. It started in Florida and it's spreading. We'll get an update at the bottom of the hour, so I hope you stay tuned. We'll begin the show by continuing our look at important bills moving through the Florida legislature. Last November, Florida voters amended the state constitution to allow most felons to vote after the terms of their sentences were completed, but the Florida legislature is attempting to add some hurdles. We're going to get a story now from Tallahassee from WFSU's Blaze Ganey, who reports that members of the public gave lawmakers an earful this week when the implementing bill for Amendment 4 came up in a House committee meeting.
Amendment 4 has been one of the most talked about amendments from the 2018 gubernatorial election. It allows felons who have not convicted murder or a sexual offense to vote, as long as they've completed all terms of their sentence, including parole or probation. During a hearing on the bill to implement the amendment, members of the public expressed their worry lawmakers are trying to change the meaning of the amendment. Some call the proposal unconstitutional. Kara Gross of American Civil Liberties Union explains why.
We are deeply concerned that CRJ3 is overbroad, vague, violates the separation of powers, and extends far beyond what any reasonable person would conclude the voters intended when they passed Amendment 4, and therefore is unconstitutional.
The ACLU believes when trying to define what offenses are sexual for the matter of having voting rights restored, the legislature messed up.
It includes too many offenses in the category of felony sexual offenses, including offenses that are not sexual offenses as contemplated by the amendment.
Some of the offenses included are human trafficking and locating an adult entertainment store within 2,500 feet of a school. But Tampa Republican Representative James Grant, who chairs the committee, says he did the best he could because there is nothing that describes what a felony sexual offense is.
I would encourage everybody to remember that there is absolutely zero legal significance to the term felony sex offense. And yet voters walking into a ballot were forced to vote on something that said an exclusionary offense is a felony sex offense. I will give you an alternative. Had the language said sex offender, that would have meant something.
In the end, the bill made it through the committee with those sexual offenses still attached, but not without several lawmakers stating their discomfort with the bill. North Bay Village Democratic Representative Michael Grieco is one of them.
I will tell you that I only have two thumbs, and they're both down on this. And if I had more thumbs, they'd be down as well.
Plantation Representative Michael Gottlieb, who works as a criminal defense attorney, also doesn't like the proposal and believes it ultimately delays the implementation of the bill.
As a criminal defense attorney, I hear a saying all the time, and I've been a criminal defense practitioner for 25 years, and the saying is, justice delayed is justice denied. And what we're dealing with here is we're simply kicking the can down the street so that individuals who should have the right to vote are not getting that right to vote longer because we have once again muddied the waters as it relates to restitution. Court costs are not restitution. Fines are not.
The bill passed with no yes votes from a Democrat. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Well, that was about Amendment 4. And if you'd like to join that conversation and talk about Amendment 4, again, we talked a little bit about it yesterday, 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. In the first half of the show, we're going to be talking about the Florida legislature, what's going on there. And we will, at the bottom of the show, talk about a devastating coral disease. So I hope you stay tuned to 88.5 FM, or maybe you're listening on the WMNF Community Radio app, or online at WMNF.org. It's 11:14 in the morning. My name is Sean Canaan, and I'm filling in for Rob Lori today on Radioactivity. Rob will be back on Monday at 11. Today, the Republican-led Florida House and Senate have released competing budget proposals for the upcoming year with major funding differences in areas such as education and the environment. The legislation outlined today also differs in many ways with the $91.3 billion spending blueprint that was proposed last month by GOP Governor Ron DeSantis. The overall House total is $89.9 billion, while the Senate figure is $90.3 billion. So both the branches of the legislature have a lower budget than the one that was released by Ron DeSantis. House and Senate committees will consider the bills next week. When it comes to education, the Senate wants an overall $1.1 billion increase for public schools, while the House increase is just $600 million. DeSantis's plan is closer to the House figure, and both legislative plans contain money for Everglades restoration and for water quality improvements. The House is below the $625 million sought by the governor, while the Senate figure is higher. So that's about the budget, which is really the only thing that the legislature is has to do, but of course they do a lot of other things, pass a lot of other bills during the session as well. If you'd like to talk about any of the things that's anything that's happening in the Florida legislature, give me a call, 813-239-9663, or you can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. In a second, we're going to talk about some health bills that are going on in Tallahassee, that some discussions about prescriptions, drugs in a minute, and also right now the overall health agenda. The Florida House is trying to reform health care in the state. In the past, efforts have yielded incremental results, but Lynn Hatter from Florida Public Radio reports that that's not stopping the House Speaker Jose Oliva, even as it sets up a potential clash with the Senate. Here's the story from Lynn Hatter.
The Florida House is tackling health care reform, and leading the way is House Speaker Jose Oliva. He describes the current state of health care delivery as...
I'm speaking, of course, of the health care industrial complex, a terribly dysfunctional health care system that is bankrupting the state and many of the individuals living in this state.
Oliva put health care reform at the top of his priority list at the start of the legislative session, and leading the way to change is a repeal of Certificate of Need. That's the system that determines where hospitals, nursing homes, and other facilities can be built. The process is long and can rack up thousands of dollars in legal bills. Republican Representative Heather Fitzenhagen is carrying the House's Certificate of Need repeal bill.
Competition in most areas is good as long as we can make sure that the public is safe. The CON should go the way of the dinosaur.
But supporters say getting rid of it could exacerbate an already existing shortage of doctors and nurses. Tearing down regulatory walls is not the only thing House leaders have set their sights on. The state is also making headway in getting more and different types of facilities up and running. Recovery care centers are aimed at cutting expensive hospital stays. Meanwhile, more doctors could soon be able to treat and advise patients remotely. Jacksonville Republican Representative Clay Yarborough says his proposal does a few things.
It facilitates and encourages the use of telehealth by authorizing all types of licensed healthcare practitioners to use telehealth to deliver healthcare services. It allows healthcare practitioners licensed in other states to deliver healthcare services to Floridians through telehealth if they register with the Department of Health.
Yarborough's bill would allow telehealth services to be offered statewide. Florida has slowly been ramping up those services during the past few years. Advanced registered nurse practitioners could be getting more leeway in practicing independently of physicians. That's courtesy of a physician. Republican Representative Kerry Pigman is an emergency room medicine doctor. He's been bringing the bill to the legislature since 2014, and his idea has historically been opposed by other doctors like Corey Howard, the president of the Florida Medical Association. Howard argues advanced nurses don't have as much training as doctors.
It's the ability to actually know how to take care of not just what's common and what appears to be common, but what comes up that's not common, that presents uncommonly, the difficult patient that goes to the, you know, the nurse practitioner with a runny nose and they wind up having a brain tumor.
Don't we do these turf issues every year? Wasn't the world going to end when the optometrists were granted the ability to prescribe certain oral medications? I don't remember the world ending when we did that. But by golly, it was years and years to get them to that point.
That's Pigman responding to the idea that advanced registered nurse practitioners should not be independent. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis has his own proposals. He wants to save the state money and cut the price of prescription meds by buying them from other countries where they're cheaper. But there are questions about whether the state can get federal permission to do that. Most of the House's health care proposals have Senate companion bills. However, few have been scheduled for hearings yet, and one, Certificate of Need repeal, is being postponed after nearly failing a Senate committee vote.
I'm Lynn Hatter.
Well, that's Lynn Hatter talking about health care reform in the Florida legislature. And if you have any thoughts, give us a call, 813-239-9663. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm filling in for Rob Lori on Radioactivity today. Rob will be back on Monday. It's 11:20 in the morning, and we'd like to hear your thoughts. I'm going to play a story in just a second about prescription drug reform. There's pull to get prescription drugs lowered by being able to go out of state or maybe even out of the country to buy prescription drugs. So we'll talk about that in just a second, but I want to let you know how you can participate in this conversation. You can text us at 813-433-0885. You can text us. That was the text number. You can also email at dj@wmnf.org, or you can call 813-239-9663. Gina writes, let's face it, Republican leaders in the legislature have no regard for the will of the people. In almost every voter initiative passed, the hotshots in Tallahassee have tried to derail what the people want. I believe Gina's referring to Amendment 4 here about felon reenfranchisement. So Gina goes on to say, now they're trying to prevent eligible felons from voting. The only way is to sue the Florida legislature, which takes money. Remember, these obstructionist lawmakers when elections come up. So that's the thoughts from Gina in Tampa. So thank you for that email. You can also email at dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. You can call 813-239-9663. Thanks for listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. One of the things that's dealing with the Florida legislature is dealing with when it comes to health care is bringing down the cost of prescription drugs. And Governor Ron DeSantis has been adamant about wanting to import medications to bring down prescription costs, but Blaise Ganey reports others are not on the same page.
I want Floridians to be able to purchase prescription drugs from Canada at lower prices. There is an avenue under existing federal law to accomplish this. The president and I have had discussions. He is supportive of this effort and has asked me to plow ahead, which will require navigating an institutionally hostile bureaucracy, as we all know. But I think it's worth the effort because this could save money for individuals, could reduce costs for our businesses, and it can relieve pressure on our state budget.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis addressing the high prescription cost in Florida. According to a state analysis, Americans spend $47 billion on prescription drugs a year.
The simple fact is that American citizens pay two and even three times higher prices for the exact same medications than the citizens of Canada.
Bill Herbshire owns the Canadian Med Store, a company whose goal is solely to help citizens order medication from Canada and other countries.
The one thing all of these people have in common is that they struggle every day to afford their life-saving medication. And they've discovered that they can buy the exact same medication at half the price from a licensed Canadian pharmacy.
To reduce those costs, lawmakers have been doing just what DeSantis requested in trying to create a program that allows for the importation of FDA-approved prescription drugs from other countries, with Canada at the forefront. Daytona Beach Republican House member Tom Leake is sponsoring the bill to create the International Drug Importation Program and the Canadian Drug Importation Program.
The Canadian Prescription Drug Importation Program allows state-funded entities to import safe and effective prescription drugs from Canada. It significantly lowers costs, and it requires federal approval.
No state has received federal approval to do so since 2003, when the federal government authorized wholesalers to import only if approved first. But Leake says he wants to try.
I think in this instance, we've got to try. What we know is that the system we have, it doesn't work for many people. And this is an opportunity for us to provide a good alternative avenue for lower cost to benefit consumers.
John Clark, chief security officer of Pfizer, one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, argues that drugs coming from the outside of the country may be counterfeits and could be deadly to Floridians.
Online pharmacies are the Achilles heel of the U.S. system. Our closed supply chain is very, very secure in the United States. But U.S. citizens are ordering online and getting tons of counterfeits. And I would say tens of thousands of U.S. citizens are dying every day because of counterfeits. We just don't know about it because they're dying of diseases that people suspect is natural when they're taking counterfeit medicines, not treating their diseases.
But Palm Bay Republican House member Randy Fine says most drugs aren't currently manufactured in America.
Well, it turns out the drug, while sold in America from an American distributor, the drug's made in China.
So the notion that if we that we have this sort of secure and protected and impenetrable system, and if we allow the rest of the world to get involved, and if we import their drugs, people are going to die. The system that we have right now is not entirely safe. And that's been very instructive to me in thinking about that. Apparently, about one in every 10 drugs that we take today is made in China.
The proposal is making its way through the House, but after multiple amendments were voted down that would add more testing and safety measures, Orlando Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith says changes must be made before he is in full support.
We have to address these issues. We cannot just put a blindfold over our eyes and just vote down all these amendments and vote yes in the underlying bill without some assurances that these issues are going to be addressed.
But Republicans are in the majority and may not need Democrat support. What the House does need is the Senate approval, and a similar bill in that chamber has not been scheduled for a committee hearing. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Well, those are two stories about health care reforms that are moving through the Florida legislature. We might have time to do one more story from Blaze Ganey from Tallahassee, from WFSU, about what's going on in the Florida legislature. But I want to remind you that you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, or WMNF.org. In just a second, we're going to talk to a scientist in St. Petersburg about what has been called one of the most extensive coral disease outbreaks ever. It started in Florida and it's spreading. So if you want to hear about coral disease in about 3 or 4 minutes, we're going to have a scientist on from St. Petersburg to talk about this horrible coral disease. We're going to wrap up our coverage of the Florida legislature for this half hour by giving out the number 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. If you tuned in thinking you might be hearing Rob Lori this morning. He will be back Monday in this time slot on Radioactivity. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm filling in today. And we're going to hear another story right now from Florida Public Radio and Blaze Ganey, the reporter that just brought you that other one. Blaze writes or says that one bill could cost stubborn city and county governments more money if they don't follow state rules. So we're going to hear this report about local preemption. So here's the report from Blaze Ganey about that. And we can take your calls afterwards. 813-239-9663.
Local governments have a lot of authority to pass rules in their area as they see fit, unless it conflicts with federal or state law. But Claremont Republican Representative Anthony Sabatini says sometimes they don't follow the rules.
Political subdivision has a certain area of behavior preempted to the state. It's no longer allowed to create regulations in that area. Some political subdivisions, some cities and counties choose to continue to create ordinances in that area. They're essentially rogue. They decide to do whatever it is they want to do.
A citizen who wants to force the city to adhere to state rules must go through the court of law, which often means hiring an attorney.
What I was surprised to learn was that when you do have to sue a local government to make them do the right thing and follow a state statute, you don't get your attorney's fees.
Sabatini's proposal would entitle that citizen to attorney's fees and cost if they win the court case. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Well, those are just a few of the stories that are happening up in Tallahassee. I wanted to alert you about. We've been talking about them during the whole session in March, but I just wanted to give you a little bit more detail with some sound from the committees and so forth. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. And we do have Dave in Clearwater on the air who wants to talk about prescription drug prices. So, Dave, what would you like to say?
Eye drops for glaucoma. I'm taking it for quite a few years, but I had trouble getting them. The Cheer One drug, and I end up with my eye doctor said, "Here's this online pharmacy. You can get them $50 a month." They were like $75 with my insurance. Okay, and the online pharmacy says they can't get them till May, I think. I'm out. And I got a replacement for it, but I went back to my other pharmacy, my regular, hard brick and mortar pharmacy, the same drug. They wanted $650 with my insurance, which doesn't cover it. It's like 13 times as much money for 1 month. I don't get the deal. Who's making a huge amount of money on this? I can't believe the online pharmacy is losing money, selling these things. It's the exact same bottle, the label, and everything is exactly the same. And I'm not got an answer from anybody. They just say, oh, well, that's what it is.
You know, a lot of it, I bet, is profits that are they're going to companies.
Yeah, who's making that kind of a profit? I mean, that's enormous, from 50 to 650 for 1 month. I mean, that's less than I pay in a year for the online pharmacy. That is exorbitant. I mean, I don't get it.
Well, Dave, thanks so much thanks for sharing your story. Is there one other thing that you wanted to say?
No, that was all. It was just, you know, a real life thing, and it's not life threatening. My eyesight may fail, but it's not a major thing.
Well, I hope that you get relief and that maybe this bill might bring the prices down. But thanks so much for your call, Dave in Clearwater. I appreciate that. We're going to move on to our next segment now in just a second. We will be right back after this short music break while I get my guest on the line. And we'll be joined by a scientist in St. Petersburg to talk about what one of my previous guests in a previous show called the most extensive coral disease outbreak ever. And it started in Florida and now it's spreading. And the number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Thank you so much for listening to 88.5 FM, wmnf.org. We'll be right back in about 30 seconds with our guest. Welcome back to Radioactivity on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan, filling in today for Rob Lori, who will be back on Monday. Well, over the last few years, a coral disease has spread through Florida, and one coral disease researcher told WMNF last year that it is the most extensive disease outbreak ever. Another researcher warned that several coral species could go locally extinct in Florida from the disease, and it's spreading now to other areas outside Florida as well. So today, our guest will give us an update about what scientists know about the disease, which has been called stony coral tissue loss disease.
With more than 500 species of birds here in Florida, We live in a birder's...
We're going to have to get our guest back in just a second. We're going to go to a quick music break. We'll have them on in just a second. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. All right, sorry about the delays. We do have our guests on the air. And joining us on the phone is Rob Ruzicka, the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute, which is a branch of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. So welcome to WMNF's Radioactivity, Rob. Hi, Rob. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Sorry about the troubles, but I want to welcome you to WMNF. Thank you for being on the air.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Well, why don't we begin with you describing what this coral disease is, what is it called, and what does it look like when a coral becomes infected?
So we refer to this disease as dystonic coral tissue loss disease, as you introduced, and it's a necrotic condition that some of the laboratory diagnosis show that it begins from the inside out of the coral. So it actually begins underneath the skeleton, the initial lesions where they occur, and then it begins to work its way on the outside of the skeleton. And what can happen is when the lesion moves to the outside of the coral, you begin to either see a banding pattern or a blotchy white pattern, and this will spread across the coral in a relatively quick amount of time. And as that banding pattern progresses across the coral colony, it actually kills the living tissue as it moves across, and then the tissue begins to either slough off or come off the coral as it's being killed by the coral. So what will happen is you will then see the white bare skeleton that is left behind that won't actually have any of the living tissue of the coral left.
When the coral dies from this disease, what does that do to the reef?
Well, the problem with it is in terms of the stony coral tissue loss disease event, just taking one step back in the bigger picture, you know, coral epidemics and coral diseases have occurred before. You know, we've been seeing them occur since the 1980s, and we have seen Caribbean-wide disease events happen. But in the past, they've generally targeted one or two species of coral at that time, and it actually, you know, the disease event or the epidemic occurs maybe for several months, you know, or a year. What's been different about the stony coral tissue loss disease event is that this has affected, we've observed lesions on more than 20 different species of the coral. So that's nearly half of the coral species that actually live on the Florida reef track, and that's what's been so devastating about this. Now, within those 20 species of coral that are affected by this, many of them are the primary architects and principal reef builders that have created our reefs, you know, over thousands of years. And so when these corals get these lesions and the entire colony is actually killed or destroyed, we're going to lose that framework and that habitat that provides homes and places for all the other fishes, many of the other invertebrates that occur on the reef. So we're going to lose that habitat complexity and those homes for all the other organisms on the reef.
Our guest is Rob Ruzicka, the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute. We're talking about stony coral tissue loss disease, which is spreading in Florida and maybe beyond. We'll get to that during the show, I hope. I should tell people that you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. It's 11:39 in the morning. My name is Sean Canaan, and our guest, Rob Ruzicka, is an expert on this coral disease that's in Florida. How and where did this coral disease begin?
So this disease was first observed and documented by colleagues of ours in 2014 in South Florida. Specifically, you know, in the Miami-Dade and Broward County area, where the first corals with lesions that were documented. And then since then, it's persisted. You know, it's now a five-year event, and it has moved through about 75% of the Florida reef tract. So there's no smoking gun that we've identified in terms of what the origin or the exact cause of this outbreak was. At the time in 2014, there was a mass bleaching event that was just beginning to begin, or just beginning at that time, and that would become a global event in 2014 and 2015 with the conditions there. So we did begin to see a lot of bleaching. Corals in Florida in general are in a perpetual state of stress and have been for decades. There was also some extensive coastal construction activities that were going on at that time. The Port of Miami was performing its dredging to deepen its port for Panamax vessels. So there could have been a confluence of stressors that were occurring either because of water quality conditions, coastal construction activities, thermal stress that was occurring in the water, and it could be a confluence of all these different stresses that could have created the start of this event. Now, where we are in 5 years later is the disease has spread northward and encompassed all of the northern portion of the Florida reef tract going up to Martin County, and our most recent observations and reports have found it off of Key West. So that's why I say it's encompassed about 75% of the Florida reef tract at this time.
And for people who might not be familiar, there are reefs in the Florida reef tract even beyond Key West.
Yes. Yep, that's correct. So we're keeping a close eye because it's been slowly progressing westward, you know, over the course of the last 5 years, and we would still have reefs in the Marquesas Islands. And then, of course, to the west of that, you would also have the dry tortugas.
A guest on my show last year, coral disease researcher Greta Abey, said that this is one of the most extensive coral disease outbreaks ever. How do you feel about that strong of a statement?
That is a 100% accurate statement by Greta. For one of the reasons that I mentioned, you know, we've never seen a disease outbreak affect this many species at one time. And nearly half of the species in Florida have developed lesions and died with it. Another characteristic of this disease event that's very unfortunate is how rapid the lesions occur. So when you have massive bleaching events and some other stressors that have affected corals, you can have survivorship or partial mortality on that individual coral when it's exposed to this stressor and it either bleaches or it has disease. What we found with this disease event is it's extremely lethal. And so the most susceptible species that succumb to this pathogen, you know, they endure complete mortality. There's very, very few survivors that get the disease and then recover from it. So that's also made this extremely devastating. I oversee one of the long-term monitoring projects for the Coral Reef Evaluation and Monitoring Project here at FWC, and in collaboration with our partners at Nova Southeastern and the Southeastern Coral Reef Evaluation and Monitoring Project. These are two of the longest tenured monitoring projects in Florida, and we have over 60 sites throughout the Florida reef tract. And for those most susceptible species, we've seen reductions in their populations on the order of 90 to 95%. So for some of these species, it's so devastating because they're being removed from the reef tract. We found a few small surviving coral colonies, but at this level, some of those species will go ecologically extinct along the Florida reef tract if something is not done. And therefore, that's why we agree that this is probably the most devastating event that we've observed.
A scientist that I've talked to about this coral disease over the last few years, William Precht, warned us that nearly all individuals, as you were saying, of certain coral species have died from this disease, and that he says that in some areas, this is essentially equivalent to local extinction of species and ecological extirpation of those species.
Yes, that is correct, because what we have found through our research programs is that many of the larger, older colonies that are those principal framework builders and architects of the reef, they have been the ones that have been most vulnerable to this event. And so we're losing these very, very large colonies. The ones that survive are very small. And what that means is that you're removing all the parental colonies across the reef tract. So the recovery is going to be very limited because, number one, you have very few corals that are mature and have the ability to be able to reproduce and provide larvae to help the reef recover. And then number two, these smaller colonies, they're going to take time to become sexually mature and be able to reproduce. And they're going to be so far spread out across the reef, you know, corals, when they broadcast spawn, they're mixing their eggs and their sperm in the water column. But they might be so far apart that that recombination and those processes that take place in the water column might be unsuccessful. So the ability for them to be able to repopulate themselves and recover naturally because of those consequences is going to be very, very difficult. So that, you know, there needs to be other actions that are going to need to be taken to help these corals recover.
Our guest is Rob Ruzicka. He's the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute in St. Petersburg. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm filling in for Rob Lori. It's 11:46 in the morning. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, or WMNF.org. And I want to ask you, Rob, these corals you're talking about, these large ones that have been devastated and that the small ones are going to take a while to recover, how old were those old coral colonies, the giant coral colonies that are dying? How long has it taken to build those up?
Well, we know from some of our colleagues at from NOAA that have done cores and actually tried to age those corals that larger ones that, say, could be the equivalent to like a small Volkswagen Beetle, those corals can be 300 to 400 years old. You know, corals are extremely slow-growing organisms that take hundreds of years to be able to build their skeletons and get to the size that they are. On the other end of this, when we've seen the lesions develop on these corals and then spread across the individual colonies, this pathogen can kill a large coral like that within a matter of months. So that's why we're so concerned about the future, because of the amount of time that it's going to take for these corals to be able to grow to a size that they can actually reproduce.
And based on what you said, that's not just a couple of years. That might be decades and decades.
That's right. That's correct.
So if I'm sitting here listening to my radio, I'm driving around the Tampa Bay area, I'm in Lakeland or Brooksville or Sarasota, I don't have a coral reef outside my door. I don't run a dive shop necessarily. Why should I care, as someone living in the Tampa Bay area, that there are coral species, lots of coral species, that are possibly going locally extinct in the Florida Keys?
Well, there's lots of people in Florida that love to visit South Florida or the Florida Keys for their recreational activities, and whether that's going scuba diving to, you know, go observe our magnificent reefs in South Florida and to go see all the corals and the fishes and the lobsters that live on that reef, whether it's for consumptive or non-consumptive activities, there's millions of jobs that are dependent upon those coral reefs, and we have millions of citizens that love to visit those locations for a variety of reasons. And so those environments and those habitats are going to fundamentally, you know, change. Without the living reef structure, you know, we could see changes to, you know, the associated populations, whether that would be fishes or whether that would be lobsters. So it would have downstream effects. It would be analogous to if you lose all your old growth trees in a mature forest, you know, that's going to have dramatic effects to the bird populations that live within that forest. So all of us, you know, there are people all around the United States that love to visit the Florida Keys and go to Miami and Broward and experience those reefs. You know, this also will potentially affect what you like to order at restaurants, because those reefs provide a supply of food and a variety of food for things that people enjoy. And those are some of both the direct and indirect impacts of the loss of some of these corals.
Our guest is Rob Ruzicka, who is the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute. We're talking about stony coral tissue loss disease on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. Rob, I want to ask you about the cause of this disease. Has the cause or the pathogen that causes it been determined?
As of this time, no, it's not conclusively determined. We have some ideas and beliefs that it could be microbial or bacterial in nature. Both laboratory experiments and in the water in the field experiments have shown that the corals respond to antibiotic treatments that have been applied. So so that would provide some evidence that it could be bacterial in nature. But other laboratory diagnoses have also suggested that it's a consortium of different pathogens that could be taking place on these lesions. So you could have bacteria, you could have viruses, you could have other parts or other organisms within that consortium. And so we don't necessarily know if the primary or secondary infections that take place on these animals is viral in nature or if it's bacterial in nature, but we know that it is some consortium of that. So there are still many scientists that are actually working to try to finalize and hopefully be able to identify what the exact pathogen is. But it's been very difficult to date, to say the least.
Well, I have some other questions for you that I'm going to hold for just a second because I'm going to take a phone call question, if that's all right with you. We're speaking with Rob Ruzicuff with the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute in St. Petersburg. And Julie in St. Petersburg has a question. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I hope that your excellent environmental stories continue, Sean, because I have learned some of the most important and yet uncovered stories about the environment, like, you know, what Mosaic's up to and the celery fields and now this coral story. You present really good environmental information on this station that's just been invaluable to me in my fight against the man over the years. And even though some of the issues are from, you know, across the Skyway in Sarasota, that's part of Tampa Bay, too, and also has a good local radio station, WSLR.
Hear, hear.
So I just want to say thank you for filling in for Rob this week. You've done a masterful job, and I want to continue hearing your voice on the radio talking about environmental issues. Thanks, Sean.
All right. Thanks, Julie. I appreciate that. Your check is in the mail. Thanks for those nice words.
Good, I need it.
I'm glad you're listening. Thanks for that. So let me ask Rob Ruzicka, our research guest here from the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at Fish and Wildlife Research Institute, more about the stony coral tissue loss disease. And I want to talk now about the spread. We've already talked about how it's spread in Florida, and I'm reading newspapers out of the Virgin Islands now and in the Dominican Republic, and I'm getting reports about this disease spreading throughout the Caribbean. So what can you tell me about where it's spreading and whether we think it's the same thing that really originated in Florida and is infecting these other places?
It's an excellent question, and it has been with our colleagues and the people that we work with both here in Florida and across the Caribbean, that we've been very worried about that this would potentially spread through the Caribbean, because we have seen other mass epidemics, whether that was the loss of the spiny sea urchin back in the 80s, be able to spread across the Caribbean. So that's right. We have confirmed reports from five different locations. That would be Jamaica, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, the Virgin Islands, and St. Martin. And although, like I said, because we don't have an exact identifying tool to confirm that it's this specific pathogen, what we have seen is that the lethality of the disease, the coral species that are affected, the types of lesions that occur on the coral are all synonymous with what we have observed in Florida. And so here at the Institute and a working group that is a multinational working group, you know, we send photos around and reports around based upon either the data or what's in those photos to confirm whether the signs that they're seeing on their reefs are very similar to what we observed here in Florida as well, too. So right now, at least we have a minimum of five other different Caribbean localities that their reefs are showing the same signs as what we saw on our corals here in Florida.
So it sounds like you don't know for sure that it's the exact same disease that for sure came from Florida, but the signs are pointing to that. If that's the case, how would a disease like this spread, and what would make it spread from, I mean, the Dominican Republic is very far from Key West.
Yes, it is. And then, you know, so is Mexico and a lot of these other locations. One of the things that we have been worried about, and there is a working group towards this, was the large commercial vessel traffic that transits all across the Caribbean. Off of Fort Lauderdale and Miami-Dade, you have two extremely large marine ports that service not only commercial traffic via cruise ships, but also container and cargo ships that move transit all throughout the Caribbean. And many of those ships, they can potentially sit at anchorage or at port for extensive periods of time. And so we don't know. Ballast water was another concern. We're not sure exactly if it's being transported in that mechanism, but at the many locations that we've seen in the Caribbean, in Mexico, and in the Virgin Islands, the first appearance of these lesions and these signs of disease have occurred adjacent to or just downstream of where their major shipping ports are. And so we're really worried that it's a carrier some way or another. There's another thought that potentially biofilms that are on the hull of ships, that this pathogen could be attached to the biofilms on these ships, and then it's transported that way. But it's being carried, because in some of the other locations, it's going against the currents, and we wouldn't expect that. We would expect that. We know that the disease can be waterborne and be carried in the water column, and that's how it's been transported locally here across the Florida Reef Tract. But the fact that it's making it these long distances against the prevailing currents was something that we were very concerned about, and it looks like vessel traffic could be a potential carrier.
Our guest is Rob Ruzicka, the Coral Reef Research Program Manager at the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute, which is a branch of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, talking on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Radioactivity Today, filling in for Rob Lori, who will be back on Monday. It's 11:56 in the morning, and we're talking about stony coral tissue loss disease. You didn't mention diving and whether it's possible that there are scuba divers who are diving in the Florida Keys and maybe it got on their wetsuit or something like that. Could they be carrying the disease? Is that a possibility?
It certainly is a possibility that we cannot rule out, because as the necrotic tissue dies on the coral colony, it sloughs off into the water column. So you can just think of like one of those little globes, when you shake it up and you get all the little snow in that globe, there would be those particles that are actually floating in the water column. So if a diver is at a reef site, they visit a reef site and where there's active lesions and infections going on, and then they get up on the boat and then they transit to another location, they could be potentially spreading that when those particles are released. Groups have taken, we've encouraged activities where vessels try to repeatedly dive, on the same reef, that they don't potentially transit from a reef that has lesions from a health, from a sick reef to a disease reef. Also, we've advocated that people sanitize their scuba equipment if they are transiting from reef to reef. So it's a possibility that we certainly cannot rule out that could be one mechanism for transporting the disease from reef to reef.
Our guest is Rob Ruzicka, and we're going to take a phone call right now near the end of the show. Jim in Dunedin, what would you like to ask?
Hi, is this me, Sean?
Tim? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay, yeah, Rob, listen, I just want to ask you if you mentioned microbial and or bacterial. Has there been any field studies that have tried the cure out in the field for a bacterial application to where maybe it would help regenerate the coral? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks, John.
Thanks for the question.
Okay.
Yep, that's an excellent question. I'm sorry, I'm getting an echo. I don't know if...
We can't hear it. If there's any way you can concentrate without, by paying attention to without it.
Sure. There have been several intervention teams that have been deployed that are actually working on that exact question. And so it's not necessarily to help regenerate the individual coral, but it's to stem and abate actually as the lesion moves through. And so what some of these intervention attempts have done is they have applied a mix of an antibiotic cream or a cream or a clay that's filled with chlorine to try to actually kill the pathogen at its margin as it moves across the coral. And in some cases, there's been some success depending upon which species of corals they're treating. In some cases, the disease still moves through that paste that is applied to the individual coral. So there are those techniques that are going in to actually try to treat individual colonies and save them.
Well, thanks for that question. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining me today on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. Rob?
Thank you for the opportunity. I enjoyed being with you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you being here. Thank you very much. If you are still on hold, or if you'd like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, give me a call at 813-238-8001, extension 114, and I'll play your message next week. So if you're still on the line, Dave, sorry about that. I didn't get to your call. Leave me a voicemail, 813-238-8001, extension 114, or anyone who has a question. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news, Facebook or Twitter at WMNF News. Thanks to our engineers, Patty Perky, DT, Frank Knox, and Max. And at 11 on Monday, Rob Loray will be back hosting Radioactivity. Then I'll host Midpoint Monday at noon. I'm Sean Canaan. Stay tuned now for Midpoint Friday with Janelle. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks for listening.
Live from